Today we begin three sessions together with consideration of problems of modern theology, and specifically for the day, a problem that is as old as theological speculation, problem of evil. It may not be a very nice topic for such a bright sunny day, but it is one that we have to face up to. A problem that perhaps some might say is a pseudo problem, since evil from person to person would vary, at least their apprehension of it, and it might seem that it's not really a problem at all. I myself would think that evil only becomes a problem for a person when he insists to himself that there must be a meaning in life. For if there's no meaning to anything, it's difficult to see how we draw our distinctions between what is conducive to good and what conduces to evil. But in religion, we probably don't have a choice. Although religion is far, far more and far deeper than just rationalization, that just thought, we are committed to a belief that there's some meaning to things in religion. Probably that is the first and the greatest content of the doctrine of God, that life means something, it's going somewhere, it has some kind of stature to it. And so inevitably, the religious person will be faced with this consideration. According to my standard of belief, reasoning might run, there is a meaning to life, and this may mean X or Y or Z. But usually, as we look across centuries at the various forms religion has taken, this meaning has something to do with man, and it has something to do with what we can loosely call good. It has something to do with beneficence, something to do with constructiveness, something to do with fulfillment. But it immediately becomes obvious that in each person's life and in our common life together, and as we grow sophisticated enough to have a sense of history, there are many elements that are not as constructive, at least on first blush. They're not conducive to good under any kind of definition, and they do not seem to be conducive to the fulfillment of life. And these kinds of elements we go by the word evil. Now, various forms of religion have been able to deal with this problem in a simpler way than that has been open to the Christian and the Jew. In religions that are not monotheistic, that do not affirm that the meaning of life has a primary principle, that this principle is one, that it's solitary, that there's ultimately a single foundation for things, these religions and these philosophies, be they dualistic, polytheistic, however they might be cast, have been able to account for evil elements in life by referring them to something other than the principle or the deity that was immediately worshipped. It is the other guy's fault, you might say. It is an evil spirit's fault. It's Satan, or it's the god of darkness, or something of this nature. This is not open to us, because of the tradition out of which we come. We cannot simplify things by a full, thoroughgoing dualism. We cannot refer things simply to the actions of someone or some force or some principle that's not amenable to that force, that principle, that someone that we worship. Monotheism, then, as it arises in the Jewish Christian tradition, perhaps around the 8th century, with the prophets, with its view that God is all, that God ultimately is in control, inevitably then, on the rational side, brings with it the complex problem of evil. Now, evil, although sometimes we may think differently, was not something invented by modern man. It's been around a long time and in most of the forms that we now experience it. And there have been satisfactory supposed answers to the problem of evil given. theology has had several, in the Christian tradition and in the Jewish tradition. But the strange and the new appearance of the problem of evil in our day has been a rejection, not for atheistic reasons or not for irreligious reasons, by some thinkers in both the Jewish and the Christian camps, but on the basis of what we might consider religious reasons, rejections of the various explanations as to why, how, and from what source evil comes to be part of human experience. There have been always those who felt that traditional solutions to the problem of evil or traditional answers beg the question or offer too much. But today, for the first time, we stand in the presence of those both within and without the church, but who are, in one way or another, parts of the Judeo-Christian heritage, who say no because of inner principles within this heritage. We cannot accept usual theological explanations of evil. Now, before I get to that, let me say that there are literally dozens of answers to the appearance of evil in the world. Maybe we ought to name some of these definitions of evil, and perhaps we ought to say something about these answers, and then we can have questions. And I'd like to illustrate some of the things with poetry, if I might, since the poets have felt this pressure and this wounding of the problem of evil, perhaps a good deal more keenly than most philosophers and theologians. First of all, evil, when we speak about it in this way, I suppose necessitates capital. We aren't talking about simple personal evils, although they would be included under evil in the term that we're using. We're talking about cosmic evil or universal evil. We're talking about forces and elements and the reduplication of actions from generation to generation that form a good bit of the stuff of human history. We're talking about elements and understandings of man and of his world that have contributed to alienation of men from men, to bitterness between groups of men, to racial hatreds, to national prejudices, to fratricidal war. We're talking about things that are seen in miniature in each one of us when we conceive dislikes for one another, but which take on magnification when they possess whole nations and races of people. Perhaps a good illustration of evil might be that which was described in the President's Commission's report on the status of civil rights and the racial problem in America, where it said, finally and at the bottom, the reason for the turmoil and the reason for the near civil war that faces us is white racial prejudice. Now here we're not talking simply about my decision or my unconscious motivation, which I have absorbed with my mother's milk, or that you have absorbed from a school teacher, or however it may come to us. But we're talking about something that, although it would be wrong to characterize it as other than ourselves, at least becomes immense when it is a swaying elemental influence on literally milliards, millions and millions of human beings, and has its appropriate response in millions of millions more. Evil is like that. It is universal, and it is particular, and its effects are measurable, and to a very large degree, they form the framework of our history. Now, where do these elements come from? The Bible presents a picturesque view, Adam and Eve, temptation, choosing their own over against the will of God, going out into the world, which in a sense is a place of punishment. Man must sweat, he must labor, he must live in a land that is full of nettles, he must earn his bread by the sweat of his face. We go on, we see Cain and Abel, we see jealousy, we see murder, We go on to see other murders. We see the rise of cities. We see the rise of ideologies. We see the rise of alienation. We see the proud man who stands against all in the universe, even against God. We see the Tower of Babel. When we look at history, we see group of people preying on group of people. We see that history and human life, as one of the philosophers has put it, has generally been, even in its savage state, which sometimes we kind of tend to glorify, human life has been nasty, brutish, short. Is this simply part of how we are? Is this essentially what we are? Or is this a denigration of what we are? Is this a corruption of what we are? Is it what we are? Is evil the real truth about life? Is life like this because the source of life is basically like this? Can it be that whatever divinity there may or may not be, can it be that whatever principles there may be is like this, or better? Can it be that whatever final person or principle there might be behind things is just neutral? He doesn't care. Emily Dickinson, one of our American poets, amazingly treats the problem of evil in a couple of lines about a flower. Apparently with no surprise to any happy flower, the frost beheads it at its play in accidental power. The blonde assassin passes on. The sun proceeds unmoved to measure off another day for an approving God. There is an idea that perhaps evil, or what we in our sentimentality conceive of as evil, is foundational to things. Robert Frost, a contemporary poet, puts it this way in a poem called Design. Now, the argument from Design has been one of the traditional arguments advanced for belief in God. Frost says, "I found a dimpled spider, fat and white, on a white heel all, holding up a moth like a white piece of rigid satin cloth, assorted characters of death and blight, mixed ready to begin the morning right, like the ingredients of a witch's broth. A snowdrop spider, a flower like froth, and dead wings carry like a paper kite." What had that flower to do with being white, the wayside blue and innocent heel all? What brought that kindred spider to that height, then stared the white moth thither in the night? What but design of darkness to appall, if design govern in a thing so small? And as we mentioned earlier, there have been those who have assumed that there is an elemental, basic principle that we can only call in our language evil in the world. And for this reason, some men have worshipped it. And for this reason, others have feared it and taken it seriously and have believed in some of the more extreme forms of dualism, as we see them in some past religions, which have some relatives still alive today, that at least this power was equal to whatever might be considered the power of good. The theological term for this would be Manichaeism, a God of goodness, a God of evil, a principle of construction that might present itself in human life as love and as brotherhood, and on the other hand, a principle which, in the same way and with the same power and with the same opportunities in life, presents itself as destructiveness, as blight. And in some of the more developed forms, the religion of Zoroaster, for example, predicts then building mythology these two principles ultimately are the cause of the world and the foundation of our life. As a struggle, it is a tension between them that produces life as we know it, in the universe as we know it. And they are locked in this timeless and eternal struggle. And the issue as to which may or may not prevail in this struggle hangs in doubt. Now for Zoroaster, and for the Manichae faith, which was a combination in some of its forms of both that basic insight that there are two powers struggling against each other, with Christianity, with its message of involvement, that man should throw himself into the world on the side of God, produced a rather heroic mentality, a rather heroic morality and ethic, that perhaps man, by his decision, perhaps man, by his way of life, might help, even though it's fractional, even though it's so minute, might help mankind as a whole to sway and tip the balance. If man be pure, towards the victory of the good. If man be impure, to the victory of the devil. And like it or not, a good deal of this kind of mythology, this kind of background, has leaked into the Christian tradition and forms a good deal of our ethical exhortation. It is not to be despised. But that places evil, as we mentioned, on a foundation with whatever it is that we might be considering God or good. And so, using that now just simply as illustration, I wish I had blackboard, don't. Let me say that we can visualize to ourselves, and this is very crude now, something of the view of what evil is by fixing the location at which the explainer of this problem fixes the origin of evil. As we know, the origin of evil is fixed in the Genesis account in a rational decision, a decision made obviously in free will by man. But there are other views, and there are other views within the Christian tradition. But now these views are cutting across the Christian tradition as I give them to you. I want you to think of a line going upwards now, and this is purely artificial, but at the base of this line now are the metaphysical elements. These are those basic elements that underlie the world, if you will, the bones of God, if I can be a poet for a moment. These are those forces struggling together, the chaos that is mentioned, the darkness without form that was void. This is a whirling whirlpool of matter that Plato talks about in the Timaeus before it is formed into a world, here on the basis of things. Historically, Western philosophy has talked about being and non-being, about what is and nothingness. But we have often mistaken non-being or nothingness to be just exactly that, a cipher. Nothing such as this was ever intended. These are two forces. These are two principles, ultimately. Now, certain elements of the philosophical and the theological tradition have identified evil at this level, at the primal basis, and not just outside of Christianity, but in Christianity itself. For the first and the greatest of the systematic theologians of ancient times, St. Augustine, located evil at this level. Evil is finally non-being. It is the resistance of the created order to the fashioning and directing of the providential God of Christianity. Evil, then, is primary. And Augustine was quite aware of Manichaeism. He was quite aware of Zoroastrianism. For a while, he had believed in it himself until he found that it was deficient. And so he is not simply giving us here a reduplication of that Persian religion, something quite other. But he is saying that finally, in the last analysis, evil is non-being. At this point, the question arises, now since this is, in a way, if I can again speak poetically, there's no other way to speak. This is the abode of God. And the question arises, are these principles of being and non-being within God or not? Are they prior to God? Does God himself arise out of being and non-being? Do they exist with God? Does he make use of them in bringing together the elements that eventually produce the world and that ultimately are the source of our life? This would be Plato, the artificer, the great craftsman, who brings these existing elements together and then creates the world. Or are these not forces exterior to God? And again, this language is purely poetry. Are they forces within God himself? Is he living as we are living? Because in his breast, so to speak, there are conflicting elements, just as they are in ours. Is he pulled in one way and pushed in another? Is the struggle finally the cosmic, universal struggle between good and evil, a struggle within God himself? And this, you might immediately say, sounds so strange, so foreign. This is not something we usually discuss at 11 o'clock on a Monday morning, and it sounds unbiblical, doesn't it? Yet this is the position of a great Christian theologian. The struggle between positive and negative forces, between being and non-being, is a struggle that goes on in the abysmal depths of God himself. Paul Tillich. It is here, finally, only the ultimacy of evil can be understood, the universality of evil, and finally, too, we can understand what we mean by the struggling, the living, the concerned God who is struggling against this force. So we might say that at that level now, down at the bottom here of our little ladder, explanations as to the origin of evil, locating it, have to do with God and the universe. But as we come up the ladder, it has other sections. The section above it would be the section we could call existence, the life of man, the section having to do with man. And there have been visions and views of evil that fix the location, the beginning point of evil here. Not now in the basic nature of the universe, not now in the secret life of God, if we can speak in those terms, but fixes the location of evil here at the point where existence is recognized, where there is a world. Here we could locate the Genesis myth. Here we could locate the myth of the fall. But there are variations even here. The Genesis story presupposes that in some sense, man primordially, basically, is not affected by evil. He is not infected. There is at best, and here St. Augustine is very subtle, and he would repay anyone's study, and I think anyone could understand him. Here at best there is potentiality in man, since he can freely choose things for himself that he will choose against the will of God. If you will, that man can choose against his own best interests. As someone said the other night when they were describing freedom at the Bible study, and there were answers followed from the people at the tables, they says freedom means being able to make your own mistakes. So in a very real sense then, the story of Adam illustrates this vision of freedom. He was able to make his own mistake. So evil then arises out of the use of man, wrongly perhaps, of powers that are in him, but are not necessarily evil in themselves. There's no necessity to evil. There is no tendency towards evil at this basic point. Evil is something, however, that is possible. There's another view, and that is the view that simply being man, being in existence, living in the world, this means that we're not God. This means that we are at best part. We're only a little fragment of the universe. We're not the whole. And we're not the most important fragment by any means. It means that we are finite. And we are limited. It means that what we know is never enough, apparently, and what we feel is never a deep enough a feeling. It means that what we love, perhaps, is always only a part. It means that in our judgments, we are possibly in error. And so existence itself, the very creation of man, the very being of man, is explanatory of sin. Man cannot help but sin and become enmeshed then, as his sin spread out, in evil. It must grow, to use the poetry of the Bible, from one man until it encompasses the whole race of man, which cuts across every color distinction, meaning all men. So we have to look there. That would be necessity. Is it by necessity or is it by possibility? Again, there are other explanations that locate sin then, not in necessity and not even by possibility, but simply man sins or man is involved in evil because these kinds of actions have happened in the past, and we have a question of custom and habit. We have a stress on environment. There is a potentiality, to be sure, but no necessity, although when pressed, the exponents of evil as being habit or tradition have to admit they cannot really mention any figures who have avoided a custom of evil. Another view coming up again through the same portion of our little ladder now, having to do with man and existence, is that ultimately evil must be explained by reference to ignorance. This is a simple view of what Socrates taught. This is a very simple view of Greek philosophy. And yet there's something in it, that ultimately it is ignorance that is explainable for man's actions and for these forces which combined on the bodies and the actions of millions of men over centuries become forces of evil. If man only knew what the result was, he would never do it. As Socrates says, I can never be convinced that if a man really knew what the effect of his action was going to be, I can never be persuaded that he would choose evil. It must ultimately be blindness. It must ultimately be ignorance. No man would choose the worst if he knew the good. And this is a very simplified way, and yet it is true enough to the basic principles of Greek philosophy to stand in a brief conversation like this. It has another ramification, that perhaps ultimately those things that we consider the principles and the elements of evil in the world are not so. But it is due to our partiality, our limited vision, that we do not know how things ultimately may turn out. We do not know what the effect of any action or any influence will be, that we name it evil. And here, it is the very same doctrine in a sense. This has become a very substantial part of the Christian tradition. It rests, of course, on many wise insights that we obviously are limited in our lifetime. None of us live more than a century. None of us has the wisdom or the depth to grasp the meaning of everything that happens. It may be that we have disguised good. It may be, for there have been other arguments, that what we consider evil are the best ways that a good God can bring about the arising of a good world. And I think modern theology will have something to say about that. Coming on up again within man, we might look at the view that locates evil in man's desires, not just in his lust. We pick so often on a few of man's desires and exclude the whole question of man's desiring. Here, Buddha would be a good example. The root of suffering is desire, he said. If you did not want, you would not feel that. the evils in the world come about because men desire things, and in their desiring for them, they lose all measure. But if desiring could be extinguished in each human breast, when men would not desire anything, they would not then enter into competition and conflict with each other, and what you call evil would vanish as a shadow that it really is in the vision of enlightenment. We might locate that as a possible origin of evil. Now the top of my pole, and it just stretches off into infinity, and you can add anything to it you like, I would call it a third section. First we had God and the universe, and now we have man and existence. And the third might, again, under the title of man and existence, be labeled society, because a very great many arguments as to how evil originates are what we might call societal or sociological. We immediately think of certain systems and certain thoughts. Perhaps we've all read some of this, that what we call evil originates because of certain dislocations that happen to man and to men in the social orders they inhabit. This is the conception, moral man in an immoral society, or forms which may seem to be neutral or have nothing to do with morality, but which in the ultimate upshot twist man, separating from himself, splitting in his personality, splitting from other men, and eventually split groups of men against other groups of men, such that war and other evils arise. It may be that we have heard of the various political and economic views of evil. There would be a rather famous one that because of the exploitation inherent in the kind of economic system that the West has fostered and developed over the last few centuries, that ultimately man becomes separated from that which he labors upon, separated from the product that he makes, separated from the work of his own hands, separated from his own family by the demands of the industrial society, separated from the earth by our plundering of the earth for raw materials, separated in more ways than one within himself and from others, so that there is produced a gray mass of men with greater thoughts and perhaps little hope due to society. And so we could prolong this indefinitely, but I think you see now that evil then really takes its flavor from where we locate the source of origin of evil to be. There are metaphysical theories about evil, and they all have something to say. There are existential theories of evil, and they too have something to say. There's social and economic and even political theories of evil. I suppose that in the master race theory, all evil came from the Jews. And they all have something to say. And in a way, perhaps any view of evil that we will eventually arrive on will have to include elements from all along this ladder of development. And perhaps views of evil and visions of what evil is fail us in that they do not sufficiently mobilize us to actively oppose it if they omit certain elements and others that I have not had time or the knowledge to mention. Well, that essentially is what I wanted to say today, so that we could have a discussion now about this. Just simply lay it out. By the way, how many of you went to see that movie last night, Let My People Go, or have seen it, about the return of the Jewish people? Can you really see this and then not realize why the problem of evil, you see, has become a paramount one in modern times? I noticed a lot of people walked out, and I sent my own smaller children out. And no matter how many times we see that in newsreel, we just simply cannot get it down. And terrible movie. It's still here in camp, and You really must see it. Fantastic. The evil in this particular thing of the treatment of the Jews by the people of Europe.
I just read a book related to this, which really followed this movie while 6 million died, and it spoke of the neglect of the British and the Americans.
Right.
And it documented how they could have helped this particular evil and not made any difference. And some of our most patriotic societies, the American Legion, the Daughters of the American Revolution, blocked legislation that would have prevented 6 million people dying. And I think evil isn't necessarily, this is as evil to me.
Oh, of course.
I think we should be aware of this too.
In other words, all of the people who are evil were in Germany.
Right. That's better thing.
We can always, and this is a problem in such a thing like this, that we get tied up in particularities. On the other hand, if you talk about it simply on an abstract level, it has no flavor, and I think we can easily go and live with the problem of evil. Because I would say one personal thing is, when I don't believe that any person who in any way has a religious aspect of his personality ought to be able to live with the problem of evil as it exists today. I just believe that. And probably this has always been true, but it has come to us in a heightened form today, for one reason or the other. Let's hear questions now, or comments, because I've come to learn.
You mentioned the fact that the ignorance of man, that if any man was really aware of what was involved in, and yet sometimes I'm sure that we're aware of what would be a better choice, and still it's this hateful thing in us that makes us do that very thing we know we shouldn't.
This is precisely what St. Paul mentions in one of his letters. And this is precisely the shortcoming of the traditional view of what Socrates taught about evil. I wouldn't be concerned to defend one side or the other. I simply will say that St. Paul is a very good psychologist at this point. He really does describe a situation that I have known in myself and that I have been informed by other people that I've talked with. This is in us. We know the better and we choose the worse. And this compounds the problem of evil, because you see, in a sense, it's all too simple if it is simply a matter of ignorance. On the other hand, there is an answer to it from the other side, because there have been strands of thought, and they still exist, and there are noble strands of thought that are sure in our culture, that say that this is too simple an idea of what ignorance is. Basically, down below this stage at which we know this is the better course and this is the worst course, and yet we choose the worst. Basically, even below this, there is this masterful ignorance that convinces us in some way that we can choose the worst at this stage and still get the good. Since apparently no one would choose to do the evil, and here again is a problem of whether we really appreciate the depth of what evil or sinfulness means. No one would choose it unless he thought that by so choosing he would achieve a good for himself. So it's just a masterful, overwhelming ignorance. So there's that kind of a thing to be said. But apparently what Paul was describing in words that strike everyone, because we all, if we reflect at all, experience it. We know one course and we know the other. This is the course that by all my training and all my better feelings, I know I ought to choose. And yet, something in me prevails and I choose this one. Now, there's a real question. Do I choose this one for the sake of some evil effect in myself, or do I not choose this one because in some way I hope to cheat the odds, you know, in the universe and achieve good?
You're sliding back and forth rather freely between good and evil and better and worse.
Right, and as I say, very loosely, let's talk about that.
Yeah, I'd like to hear your comments. Mm-hmm. It seems to me you're talking about some of the qualitative versus expensive.
Yeah, well, I myself would not want to give a substantial reading to what evil might be or good. I would think of it more as a qualitative thing. And I believe that what I've said at several points along the little ladder, whatever, the little pole, would bear out my own particular thinking at this stage, that evil would be a term we would apply in the presence of actions, elements, attitudes, and feelings that have destructive consequences. Consequences that tend to separate men from men, that tend to set up partial goods as the good, actions that tend to discriminate in favor of one side as over against another side. I don't know how to proceed any further. In other words, it would be the choice of a particular person or nation or idea as over against others in such a way that it would have these consequences in the future. The possibility of conflict, whether or not it was physical conflict, would be immaterial. Whereas good, if you're going to use those as the primary ones, good would be those kinds of choices and attitudes and outlooks which tend to universalize, which tend to open up, which tend to embrace everyone, which tend to overcome distinctions which become at least the occasions for conflict.
Yes, sir. The process of justification,
well, now let's come to that.
Well,
yeah.
Isn't some of the ego we perform really the process of justifying ourselves?
Oh, yeah. Now you mean in the sense of self-justification?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
That's
right.
That's
beautiful. Yeah. I thought you wanted to jump to a theological doctrine or something. No. Yeah. Of course, that's true. That in a sense, self-justification, which we all do probably at every moment, is conducive to this kind
of thinking. Well, I'm thinking of myself as a very pastor, you see.
Yeah.
That so many of the things that are done in relationship to the congregation and the individual members is really sort of a process of justification. I mean, I try to justify, even though I'm sure that something else is a lot more ideal. I justify it on the basis that maybe peace within the membership is better than, you know.
In other words, a partial good is better than a possible good. Is that a partial sure?
Well, an ideal good.
Yeah.
You want to call it.
Yeah.
And we're really hung up on this. And how would it be possible to completely, well, go to complete good?
I do not know. And I am sure of one thing only in your question that I can answer, and that is that never will we achieve a complete expression of goodness. That seems to me to be the outer limit.
Aren't you a much safer ground if you wouldn't use that terminology? Why don't you put the Pastor Scholl's question in terms of better, maybe in terms of utility?
Well,
let alone, unless you're going to talk about something which is absolute, vice versa, more evil than good.
Well, basically, I'd be very warm to a pragmatic approach, but yet I do think that we perhaps lose a very good deal of the problem when we speak in utilitarian terms. For example, the metaphysical term that we mentioned. I don't believe that any mature view of what evil may or may not be, and of what an answer to evil may or may not be, and I have no idea as to the answers to those two questions, are going to be even possible if we restrict ourselves simply to the utilitarian terminology, or we think of it in terms of better or worse. Not because it implies relativism. Our whole thinking is based on that, but because it foreshortens or truncates the problem, and we tend to think of it only, you know, in reference to this sphere in which we can rationally operate. And if the poets have felt anything, if the books of the Bible can communicate in whatever indirect way anything, if the lives of philosophers and of sensitive individuals, as history presents them to us, even in a shadowy way, show anything, it is that the whole question of what good and evil are and how they conflict are not finally to be handled simply on a rational basis and simply in terms of better or worse. Now, what the other alternatives are, I do not know. I think that anyone who would say so at this point would be foreshortening himself, or a book would be foreshortening its approach, because the problem, it seems to me, is moot, and it's timely, and it's with us. Yes?
But aren't you, say, foreshortening yourself? You're excluding certain ways of approaching this problem.
No, not at all. I'd be glad to use them. I simply say I'm afraid that the danger is that when we begin to talk simply in these terms, the other parts drop out. And this has been the tendency in modern thought, as you are well aware.
Yeah, but I say you're afraid of talking this way, so you don't want to talk this way.
No, let's talk in that way if you want, but be careful of this, that terminology of better or worse, ultimately, unless it could be stretched in a way of which I have no knowledge, and that's possible, is not going to be able to take into account metaphysical problems, whatever they may be. But that evil is deeper than just simply a dislocation or something.
You see the dangers, though, in the way that you want to approach it. For example, you turn the problem of evil into an objectified problem. You treat evil implicitly, in much of what you were saying, you were treating evil as a substantive thing.
That's right.
Talk about the origin of evil. It's got a capital E, you said. One of the dangers of this is that it keeps us from seeing evil existentially. Now, one thing that I think we all, that evil for most of us is not a philosophical problem, it's a moral problem. Mm-hmm. In that the one thing of which we are immediately aware is that we know the good and do not do it. I would suspect that this would be the most fruitful place to begin a discussion of evil. This is where we begin all experience of all knowledge.
This is where we begin traditionally, too. And I would be afraid of it for this reason. Now, what you talk about as the dangers very probably are there. I don't know. But I would suggest that it is not possible for us to begin at that point for these reasons. It assumes that we know the good, and I think that is exactly what is in question, among other things. And it also assumes a rather simple idea, which we were talking about here when we talked about is evil, you know, simply a result of ignorance or something, that we know one good and we know another thing is less than good, yet we choose that. I do not really believe that dealing with it on the moral level alone is going to help us, for the simple reason it is a theological problem, and morality is an aspect of every theological statement, to be perfectly sure, and nowhere clearer than in this, but it involves more than that. Now,
you misunderstand. When I say it's evil, confronts us first of all, primarily as a moral problem.
Oh, of course.
I mean, that it confronts us in a situation where our capacity to do or not to do that which is evil is presupposed.
We presuppose it. I wonder whether that is the case.
I think it is, in fact, presupposed in our initial confrontation with the problem of evil. This is where we run into it. I would wonder whether all of these reflections about the origin of evil and all of these dualisms and everything, all the philosophical systems, are not elaborations of the primal insight, which is existential. The question having to do with man's authentic existence. It's the immediate recognition, something that is immediately given in experience, that we are capable of choosing the better, or the worse. And we sometimes choose the worse. And now we begin to speculate, and we wonder why.
I would suggest that, although you're certainly right, this is where men come to it, when they come to it, that it is perhaps an immature way of doing it. I think that you're perfectly right, too, that the various systems arise out of a way of trying to explain our dilemma. But there is this to be said, that take a human being, myself, yourself, or anyone else, and I have this complexity now. I'm called upon, or I feel I've got to make a decision. It's in my own self-interest, or perhaps it may be more noble than that. It's in the interest of the group or something. And there's the good, and there's a less than good. There's the better and the worse. If there were a unitary content of this better and worse, or this good and evil, then we might have something to talk about. But such is not the case. That which has been considered in men's existential situations and their complexity, not only throughout history, but across the world at any one time, the content has differed. The content differs.
Well, you and Paul are having trouble.
Aren't we?
Because you're a couple of fatheads.
We're perplexed. Oh, right. Right. I agree with you. We're perplexed.
Trying to perform a quantum. Huh? It's not something that you do. Good and evil is something that is. Better or worse is performance. And if you think about doing better or doing worse, and think of the other two as being qualitative or states, you don't get hung up in the direction of your background.
Paul? Paul, you want to answer that?
Well, we used to go around on justice. The capital J.
Yeah.
Ask my capital J justice. So
I only use the capital J
convertibly, and I was trying to stay in his. I was trying to stay within the area to which he had led me. But you respond to it.
Well, I've got to say only one or two things about that, and that simply. This, I don't want to substantialize or quantify or whatever this business of good and evil, and I would prefer myself to be able to stick on more existential ground, very much so, and talk in terms of better and worse. And I'm sure that's the way I live, as most people live every day. It's the way I see a lot of problems which face us right now, as Paul knows, perhaps better than others here from knowing me. And yet, on the same time, again, this business of there being states, and I realize this is the way St. Paul does present this business. It's two eons, you know. This is very, very traditional, and it's very honorable, and it's a way of proceeding. It's a way of doing something. Something needs to be gotten done, but. I cannot, in all honesty, now see that it is particularly helpful, and this is arguing against what I've said previously in some ways, when you say it's the question of doing evil, the question of states. It's this gap here between our actions and then what we know, that much is in Paul's example, and then this spiritual power, or this eon back here. It's these gaps which we rather freely go across in our everyday language, and I do as much as the next man. It's this, I think, that hides the problem. Now, Paul was a lot deeper than this, of course, in his writings, and was probably kind of speculative, not only in the writings that come down to us, but in other writings and in his personal converse, because he was misunderstood. And one place, and I've forgotten the scripture the way I should know it, but he says, do we teach, or some words to this effect, that we do evil that good may come? Remember, this was one of the problems that was faced. And if you want to talk on an existential level, and picking up my response to Paul Haney a moment ago, that the content of what is better or worse or good or evil tends to vary between groups of men and from man to man within the same group, we would have to say that a good bit of our human experience may just rest on our decision to do what appears evil with the hope that good might come, without in any sense wanting to send us away to something more practical at the moment, or get us away on the war or something. We might say that perhaps every war, in a sense, has a justification within thinking minds in this respect. And there are many, many other things less ultimate than war that are also justified in that way. So that I wish I had a very clear alternative in mind, but I would lie to you if I said I did. And I would imply that while there are many people who have thought longer on this than I, that have something more of an alternative to offer, I would think that at this particular point in human history, we're all pretty muddy on this. And I would like with you not to mystify in any respect, but to explore with you now just this muddiness and see if we can find out what the real problems are. There's another hand, another person. Yes, sir.
Well, it's one of our problems that we externalize. Well, for example, I get back to the parish business.
Sure.
In my externalization, I say a guy goes fishing on Sunday morning, he's doing something evil for us. And I'm doing something real good if I'm getting up and preaching. On the other hand, it's quite possible that for Sunday morning I'm going over there because it's 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. I'm not going over for any good reason. I'm not loving God, I'm not loving fellow man. I'm getting paid and I'm over there. So really, in spite of the external comparisons, it's possible maybe that I'm performing more evil with my act than the fellow Christian. It's possible, isn't it?
We're lost if we don't believe that we can do evil and good come of it then.
Well, but it was one of our deals that we tried to do this with an external act.
Yes. That's right, and of course what you illustrate is certainly not something that we make fun of you about, because it happens to every one of us in one way or the other. It's too shallow a conception of the better or the worse, even, without even getting into good and evil at this point. Perhaps too shallow a conception. And here I would think that we might very well take the utilitarian or pragmatic common sense approach and simply ask about what is the upshot of that action? What is the upshot of the going fishing or the going preaching or the going to church or not going to church? What does it finally all add up to in a way? And here, of course, this is where I live myself, and this is where I'd like to talk. And it seems to me that at least in a problem of this nature, it's helpful to begin. What really is the upshot? In some way, does the level of this life in the people who are exposed to the sermon in ourselves drop? Does the man going off finally get a perspective on himself that may in some way cut down the bickering at home? I don't know. I would say, what's the upshot at this point? Because I would think again, and I'm sure that you recognize it, this is not really a problem of evil. I would have to agree now with Paul at this point. This may be a problem, I don't even see it as a moral problem. Maybe it's just that I'm blind. It's a personal kind of problem. It's a societal problem. I can't see that it really touches in any serious way on evil. Let me say why the problem of evil, besides all of the events that we are all more or less familiar with, war and apparently that man has used his increasing knowledge not only to assist men in their lives, but also to take their lives and to torture and kill. But a certain figure, theological figure today, has presented from the standpoint of a Jewish religious person, the problem in great respect. His name is Richard L. Rubenstein, and he's the campus chaplain at the University of Pittsburgh. You may probably have seen some essays on him in Time or in the newspapers or other sources or read his books. The first of his books was At the Opposite, meaning Jewish theology after the fact of the so-called final solution to the European Jewish problem by the death knell. And he's written another book called Religious Imagination, which is somewhat different and yet is under the aegis of his first book. And now he is writing another book called Religious Courage. Just to put it briefly, and I know it's time for us to go, Rubinstein affirms in the Jewish tradition, and whatever is done in the Jewish tradition cannot help but affect us in the Christian tradition, since we stand together as this one and the other, it is part of our identity. He affirms that those whom he respected so much that he talked to in Europe when he was inspecting the death camp, both Jewish rabbis and Christian pastors and theologians, and even those, and he mentioned one very famous and lovable German pastor who himself went into the death camp and himself suffered and says it wasn't a question of some surface prejudice or anything in his case. Says those who affirm that we must accept it, and this is something you'll notice that I didn't have on my poll yet, I was going to put on in a moment or in the next hour, who affirmed that in the providence of God, this happened. That ultimately, in the divine plan, it will work for good. He says those people have not considered the enormity of evil. They have not really wrestled with it. And he, for his part, said that for the Jew, he can only live in God's absence, believing that God was not in it. And for this reason, he's been identified as a death of God theologian. But he says it seemed to him less religious to affirm what has been, through not only popular religion, but the more serious theological thinking of the churches, both the Jewish and the Christian, that this, in its way, as all other great evils, are providential, than to simply say no to this. I cannot accept it. And with your permission then, it's almost time for lunch. We'll break, and Wednesday morning, perhaps I'll say a little more about his thought and about some other thinkers who are dealing with this, and we'll take it at that point. Because you see, this strikes below, in a sense, it's not an answer to the questions that you men have very validly raised, but it strikes below both a utilitarian, everyday, and existential, even a very scientific approach to the better and the worse, or perhaps the good and the evil. It strikes below even the metaphysical foundations that man has erected over the centuries to deal with it. It strikes at the very heart of something I said at the beginning of the hour, which I know is subject to challenge, but you haven't challenged yet, about meaning in life. It has something to say about God. And although it may be a pseudo-problem, as I've expressed it, it is not a pseudo-problem as far as our life experience is concerned. And I think it is well worth our wrestling with it for a while. Thank you very much. If you'd like to do some reading in a Protestant theologian, our bookstore has this little book from Association Press, the YMCA.